Welcome back to the show, Pompey the Great and the Fall of the Roman Republic podcast. I'm your host, Alan Keith. We will be talking about the war with Sertorius in Spain. And you'll also notice that I will be absent my co-host, the charming Mr. Luke Murphy, for the next couple episodes. Apparently, Luke's really tied down with work and a lot of family business, and I think someone hit his car and completely totaled it a couple weeks ago, so he's getting all that stuff sorted out. And I said, hey, you know, I think I can probably cover these episodes, you know, I've got my notes, and if you're not there, I can say whatever I want. So we said, yeah, go ahead, let's keep the show going, and I do apologize for the delay in the episodes, listeners, but we're gonna get through this. In the last episode, we covered the Lepidus Revolution, which I don't even think we called the revolution, I think we called it an affair or something like that, because we didn't take it very seriously, and it doesn't look like a lot of people in Rome did. But in that episode, the revolutionary Lepidus formed an army, yada yada. In a short story, he marched on Rome. I'm not exactly sure where that episode ended, but I know it was before the war in Spain, naturally. So if there's a little overlap, I apologize for that, folks. But there are a couple important things I think happened in that last episode that is going to play into Pompey's conquest of Spain. First of all, this Philippus character, this advocate of Pompey. Philippus was the man who advocated for Pompey taking the field against Lepidus. And he also is going to advocate for Pompey to take the command in Spain. Now, after Lepidus' army is defeated by Catulus, the Remnants escape and they're hunted down by Pompey. And Lepidus actually does escape from Rome. Lepidus sails to Sardinia, hoping to interrupt the grain supplies there. He dies for some bizarre reason, and his lieutenant, and here's the important part for this episode, his lieutenant, M. Perna, decides to take over command and sail to Spain to join Sertorius. And we believe that the ships at Cosa, where Lepidus escaped on the coast, were supplied by Sertorius himself, or possibly the Cilician pirates who were likely in league. And we're going to talk about this possible, conspiracy or our joint organization between Sertorius, the Cilician pirates, and Mithridates as the episode goes on. So that's a pretty interesting alliance, which I thought was probably one of the most serious ones that Rome ever faced. And as we've already covered why and how Sertorius is in Spain and the occupation he has there, we're not going to cover it again. But it's important to know that Perpurnia landing in Spain worsened the situation. If you recall, we have Metellus Pius trying to deal with that situation in Spain. He wasn't faring well against Sertorius, who's an amazing commander. And the situation magnifies with Perpurnia landing. And of course, all of Rome's aware of this. Now, Pompey realizes that there's a problem and that Rome is going to need an experienced commander to take the field against Sertorius, and he wanted the job. Catulus, who was consul, ordered him to disband. Pompey refused, coming up with excuse after excuse, sort of the old tactic that his father used, and the exact thing that Sulla tried to prevent with his Sullan reforms, which is the main reason why the reforms failed miserably, in my opinion. And while Pompey refused to disband his troops, which I know we covered in the last episode, his supporters tried to break down the senatorial reluctance in Rome. You know, the same thing his father Strabo did 10 years ago. Black propaganda was rampant for Pompey's intentions, and he legitimately was throwing the fit to get the command in Spain, and that's the reason behind that. It was agreed by all parties that Metellus did need help to defeat the Sertorian forces in Spain. But what's funny is that both consuls, who were related to the Brutus and Lepidus who were killed, both consuls, Lepidus and Brutus, flatly refused to go to Spain. Eventually, a senior statesman, and mentor of Pompey, the L. Philippus, who I mentioned earlier, seized the opportunity and proposed Pompey for the commission due to his experience and despite technical disqualifications. Pompey was not even a senator yet, so he was disqualified from even commanding an army, which was usually commanded by consuls, praetors, propraetors, proconsuls, which we've mentioned before. So I'm not going to get into that, but Pompey was like 29 at this time and, you know, was technically disqualified. Philippus jibed the consuls by stating that Pompey should not be given proconsul authority, but pro consilibus are both consular authorities. Basically, that since both consuls are too afraid to go, that Pompey should go alone with the authority of both consuls. You know, it, jokes like that don't really raise, you know, hardly raise an eyebrow today, but, you know, Philippus's contemporaries would have delighted in them, and he's basically mocking the consuls for being cowards, you know, when consuls were the first choice to leading armies in Republican Rome. Anyway, with Philippus's rhetoric, the Senate agreed. Within 40 days, Pompey recruited new troops and provisions. The historian Galba gives us the figures at 30,000 infantry and 1,000 cavalry. It was larger than the army Pompey commanded against Lepidus, and it shows how worried and truly weak the Sullan government was. I'm sure that between the two of us, we gave you some background on Sertorius before and how he has made his way to Spain. On Pompey the Great's staff, we have L. Afranius, D. Laelius, and probably Gabinius, and we'll hear from him in future episodes, and he's the one who puts forth the Gabinian law later on, which we'll get to, and his close friend and advisor, the scholar M. Varro. C. Mimius, which is Pompey's brother-in-law, we mentioned that, was already there under Metellus, but became Pompey's quaestor, so he moved over to Pompey's camp once he arrived. And although Varro, who I think eventually goes on to produce a pretty nice biography off Pompey and a natural history of some of the findings they find in the East, Mithridates' library and like botany, I think a lot of these things are allegedly recorded in his works, which are tragically lost. How amazing it would be to get a hold of that. But I'm guessing Varro is definitely a close friend and advisor of Pompey, but he also has a lot of scholastic ability. And although Varro produced for Pompey a naval itinerary describing the sea route to Spain from Italy, the situation required travel by land. This meant crossing the Alps and traveling along the coast of Spain. Thus, Pompey crossed the Alps, pioneering a new passage there. Along the way, Pompey defeated some hostile Alpine tribes, which he later said were already at the Italian throat. Pompey's next move down the valley of the Durance towards the independent Greek colony and port of Massilia. He crossed paths with the Saluvi, a hostile tribe to Rome and Massilia. And it's interesting that Caesar indicates in his Civil War commentaries that Pompey defeated that tribe and annexed their land to Massilia and increase the revenue. We don't have a lot of information on these Gallic campaigns of 77 by Pompey, but Cicero later does describe Pompey as leading his legions to Spain through a welter of carnage in a transalpine war. Lucian, who was a 3rd century AD poet, also repeats this in his epic poem, and it's safe to say Pompey dealt with some pretty hard fighting on his way to Narbo. Now, at this time, Sertorius controlled nearly all of Spain, except for some coastal area near New Carthage, which was controlled by Metellus. And in the winter of 77, we find Metellus wintering at his headquarters in Corduba, while Sertorius had made his winter quarters at Castra Aelia. There, Sertorius was manufacturing weapons and clothing and the allied cities for his scattered troops. Now, Sertorius had been on the Spanish peninsula for quite some time, and we've mentioned in other episodes that he'd even gone so far as to Romanize a lot of the citizens and provide schooling. He was very influential and ingrained in the Spanish culture and was admired and helped by many, many Spanish tribes. Now, Sertorius was a brilliant commander, and he deduced that Pompey's plan would be to secure the coast from New Carthage to the Pyrenees by winning over the tribes and cities there He would link up with Metellus and establish a base from which it would be possible to penetrate into the interior of Spain. Sertorius is given a lot of credit for this, but in my mind, it doesn't take a genius to see that Pompey would secure his own supply lines by sea and hopefully cut off any help that might come to aid Sertorius from the Cilician pirates. Another of Pompey's chief objectives would be the plains of Valentio, where there might be good opportunities to forage for his army. Now, Paperna, who we've mentioned, after he landed in Spain, he was actually forced by his own troops, who would not march with him unless he joined Sertorius as a subordinate. And when his forces learned Pompey had landed, 20,000 infantry and 1,500 horse were sent and joined with Herennius, another one of Sertorius's subordinates, to guard the lower portion of the river Ebro. There they hoped to lure Pompey into an ambush. Herennius was instructed to keep Metellus pinned in his province and avoid a pitched battle. And meanwhile, Sertorius marched up the Ebro against the tribes there that had solicited aid to Pompey. Now, though it is believed that Pompey ignored the appeals of the Berenices, mainly because he didn't want to be lured into a trap of Sertorius's design, instead he crossed the Pyrenees by the coast while receiving submission from the tribes there. So apparently Sertorius still found the need to deal with these tribes who may or may not have solicited aid to Pompey the Great. Meanwhile, Pompey's brother-in-law, C. Memmius, along with the able Spaniard Balbus, sailed with a force to New Carthage under Pompey's orders. And Balbus was a local Spaniard who eventually will earn the consulship, and we'll hear about him in Caesar's campaign because he eventually becomes a loyal creature of Caesar. So Memmius and Balbus sailed with an able force to secure New Carthage and march up the coast to join their chief. Unfortunately, Memmius was blockaded there by the allied pirates and was subsequently unable to play his part in the campaign. Meanwhile, Sertorius planned to establish a solid base in northern Spain, where he would be ready to aid his subordinates as needed. First things went well for Pompey. He outwitted Paperna and Herennius and crossed the Ebro and advanced in several columns to the plain of Valentia. Here Pompey met his main opponent for the first time. Sertorius heard what Pompey had done and marched rapidly south to blockade the town of Lero between Valentia and Saguntum. Here Pompey had collected his forces on the river Palantia, presumably with the intention of attacking Valentia, where the Sertorian commanders had taken refuge. The siege of Lero successfully diverted Pompey's attention from his project, and he was cunningly drawn by Sertorius into a deep trap. What has come to be known as the Battle of Lero is the best documented incident in the whole war, and well illustrates Sertorius's technical superiority at this time. Sertorius was ready for all of Pompey's maneuvers. Indeed, he even set the opening for Pompey to fall into. So, and Sertorius brilliantly frustrated Pompey's every strategy in one stroke. With 10,000 men and his entire transport lost in the skirmish, Pompey had to give up all chances of joining forces with Metellus and reestablishing Roman control over eastern Spain. Pompey retreated north of the Ebro, set up winter quarters, and licked his wounds. Eventually, Pompey was joined for winter by Metellus, who had defeated Hertilius at Italica. However, they both needed supplies, and the Senate was reluctant to comply. A lot of the sources we have are really mixing up Pompey's motives here with his eagerness to attack Sertorius. Some sources say that he was trying to get the war over and done with as quick as possible. Others constantly talk about Pompey's vanity, his willingness and his wantingness to end the war single-handedly before Metellus could join with him. So you kind of have both sources here. Some sources tell us that Pompey was constantly engaging in battle without the aid of Metellus so that he can reap the rewards and victory of defeating Sertorius on his own. Other authorities believe that Metellus was probably unable to join Pompey in a timely manner, and Pompey thought it expedient to wipe out the Sertorius threat as soon as possible. Sertorius and his legates likewise spent the winter in Lusitania, recruiting a new army to replace the 20,000 lost at Italica. Very interestingly, Mithridates, who was again expanding his Asian empire, was convinced to form an alliance with Sertorius, and a disputation arrived with money and ships. Mithridates wanted recognition of his rights to Asian conquest. the Senate and Sertorius refused to abandon Rome's claim to her own province. And of course, Sertorius in Spain had set up a sort of a mock Senate with all the best men he could find. But the two parties agreed to recognize Mithridates' possession of Bithynia, Cappadonia, Galatia, and Paphlagonia. Additionally, Sertorius offered to lend Mithridates an officer who would help train and equip the Mithridatic forces and in the Roman fashion and familiarize them with Roman legionary techniques. So, and this is the point I want to make when we find Pompey in the East in a few chapters. He's going to be facing forces much different than the ones that Sulla faced. And after Mithridates is schooled in the art of Roman warfare, Sertorius was also to receive 40 ships and 30,000 talents annually. Rome now faced a three-front war and did not control the sea. Orosius tells us that Pompey captured the cities of Belginda and Celtiberia during the winter, and Sollus also mentions Pompey being active during winter. This is thought to mostly gain his raw recruits more experience and fitness. Thus, despite early setbacks, Pompey remained on the offensive. And so Sollus basically tells us that Pompey utilized the winter to train his raw recruits and get them in shape for fighting. In the spring of 75, the Sullan generals repeated their tactics. Metellus passed through central Spain towards the further province in hopes of a decisive victory against Herculius. Again, Pompey moved south towards Valentia, but met no serious resistance on the march until he arrived at Valentia itself. Herennius and Perperna were formed up at the river Turia. Pompey joined battle in the narrow space between the river and the city walls and heavily defeated the enemy. Valentia was sacked and Herennius was killed, along with 10,000 men. At the same time, Pompey received news that Metellus had met Hertilius at the city of Segovia. There he won a decisive victory, killing Hertilius and his brother. Meanwhile, Perperna fell back to join with Sertorius and formed a defensive line at a river about 30 kilometers away. Now, we are seeing clearly here that Pompey is attempting to overwhelm the enemy and stay constantly on the offensive. Some historians see it as arrogance, but, you know, in this entire Spanish campaign, the only real adversary with any real ability Pompey is going to face is Sertorius. Sertorius's other legates are pretty easily defeated. We will see some interchanges between Sertorius and Pompey, where Pompey is well schooled in the art of guerrilla tactics. On the battle that follows, we have some disagreeing sources between Plutarch and Appian. According to Plutarch, Pompey was elated with the battle at Valentia, and Pompey hurried to fight Sertorius before Metellus could join him, seeking all the glory for himself. And according to Appian, Pompey hurried for battle only because he knew Sertorius would be more likely to fight inferior numbers. And Pompey therefore calculated the risks. Whatever Pompey's motives were they tactically sound or were they just for personal glory? He again underestimated Sertorius's skill. I want to make a note that Sertorius had been in Spain for quite a while now, and if Pompey was not indeed solely seeking glory, his tactic of trying to engage Sertorius would have been a pretty sound technique, given that Sertorius was prone to guerrilla tactics, you know, hit-and-run type skirmishes. And it's very reasonable to assume that Sertorius would not risk his entire campaign on one pitch battle that he didn't know for sure that he would win. With the battle lines formed, and Afranius on Pompey's left against Perperna, and Pompey on the right against Sertorius, Afranius pushed through Perperna's lines, taking the Sertorian camp. But Sertorius, who had deliberately weakened his right flank in order to strengthen his left, Pompey was overwhelmed and suffered heavy losses. He himself was lucky to escape with his life and suffered a wound to his thigh for his trouble. He also had to abandon his horse, which was richly decorated with gold trappings and the like. And apparently Pompey abandoned his horse to divert enemy pursuit as they ransacked the valuables on his ride. So probably pretty horrible near-death experience there, but pretty clever to leave the poor horse for the greedy men. With the timely arrival of Metellus, the Sertorian forces had to retreat. The whole art of these ancient styles of fighting was really attacking when you have your enemy at a supreme disadvantage. A lot of time you have two enemies formed up where neither attacks, and it's really the job of both generals to maneuver and counter-maneuver their troops until their enemy is at a disadvantage or that they are at a superior advantage so that they can press an attack that gives them an unassailable advantage. So naturally, with Metellus showing up just in time, Sertorius was forced to retreat. And again, I've got to say that even toddlers carrying spears on a different front than their enemy will cause you to change tactics. If another enemy appears, you have to formulate a new plan. The Sertorian forces retreated to the area around Saguntum. They were again brought to battle, which lasted half the day near the river Turia. According to Appian, Sertorius again put himself opposite Pompey and defeated him, killing 6,000 of Pompey's men. His victory was negated by Metellus defeating Perperna and subsequently killing 5,000 of his men. The next day, Pompey was able to stop a daring attack on Metellus' camp. Metellus was wounded in battle, and Memmius, who had joined Pompey in the Battle of Sucuro, was killed. So, there's the end of Pompey's brother-in-law. What happens next is largely unclear. Sertorius seems to have again offered battle, but without any relevant advantage, Pompey and Metellus didn't join the battle. And Metellus eventually withdrew to winter quarters in Gaul. And Pompey, unable to secure enough supplies for his whole army, gave 1.5 legions to his legate, Titurius, and moved on to the Vesones at the western end of the Pyrenees. During 75, we see that the war had started going Pompey's way. Sertorius had twice outgeneraled Pompey, and his guerrilla tactics continued to bring success. However, two of Sertorius's best generals were dead, and he failed to beat the butcher boy decisively. Sertorius was also losing control of his men and his Spanish allies, and it is to Pompey's credit that he was able to keep his army spirit high despite the losses they suffered and Pompey's own relative inexperience. He was also able to continually stay active against Sertorian forces, and with continuously wearing down Sertorius, defeat was surely imminent. And we'll absolutely see as this podcast goes on that the ability to control the morale and confidence of your men has a lot to do with life and death and victory and defeat on the battlefield. We'll see it again and again in Julius Caesar's men being starving and outnumbered and still prevail. And then we'll see in generals like Lucullus, who had the numeral superiority and tactical advantage over King Mithridates. We do see his troops eventually mutiny in the east before Pompey takes command, but that's another chapter, certainly. So, Sertorius's defeat was seemingly imminent. Pompey could not, however, continue a war of attrition without supplies and reinforcements. And apparently Pompey sent repeated overtures to the Senate requesting fresh supplies of money and men. During the winter of 75, Pompey was so frustrated and desperate for supplies, he sent a strongly worded letter to the Senate. He complained of their lack of effort to keep him supplied, their unwillingness to support him, and he warned if they did not send help, they could expect an invasion of Italy if he had to abandon his campaign. Now, I think that threat or that warning or whatever you want to call it is more to the fact that if he has to abandon his campaign, the enemies will eventually march on Rome, though I suppose it could be a double meaning. Some people say that it's a double meaning that Pompey will march on Rome, you know, which is really more just black propaganda against Gnaeus Pompey. And we've stressed this 5 times already. Pompey had numerous occasions to unassailably control Rome and march against Rome's liberty and chose not to. So I'm going to go ahead and say that comment in the letter is referring to if the Senate does not concede to Pompey's wishes of fresh levies and supplies, they need to expect that Sertorius and his army are going to march over the Alps. As a result of the letter, 2 legions, money, and supplies were duly dispatched. Plutarch's narrative here abruptly ends with the Spanish War and dumps, spoiler alert, to Sertorius's murder. Appian, however, is the only clear account that remains. He describes some 3 more years of fighting, possibly, where Metellus and Pompey went over more and more towns and tribes in central Spain. Frontanes records a strategy of Pompey's to secure control of a particular towns whose inhabitants refused to take in Pompey's legions, but eventually agreed to take in the generals wounded. There, Pompey disguises his best soldiers as his wounded, and once inside, they simply seize the town. Sort of your Trojan horse type deal there. In 74, Sertorius did win several victories, but the Solon forces were unrelenting, and they were a numerically superior force. And that seems to be a trend we'll see in some of Pompey's battle strategies. I think there is something to be said about the ability to survive and even succeed in victory when you're grossly outnumbered. There's also something to be said of the stratagem of never being caught in a disadvantaged position. And Pompey, we'll see that his ability again to overwhelm the enemy with numeral superiority. If he's in a position where he can be well supplied, well fortified, and have fresh reinforcements and hit everything with his biggest hammer, that is a strategy we're going to use. And here we see it wearing down Sertorius. And as the Spanish War is coming near its end, Metellus makes a proclamation that he would reward 20,000 acres of land to any Roman that would betray Sertorius. Sertorius became paranoid and exchanged his bodyguard with a Spanish bodyguard, which apparently the Spanish apparently make pretty reliable bodyguards, or maybe it's just that they aren't politically influenced by the elite at Rome. Because I've come across a few accounts of Roman generals using Spanish bodyguard for whatever reason. I'm gonna have to look that up. But there was another little known man at the time named Julius Caesar, who towards the end of his dictatorship does take up a Spanish bodyguard. But that is chapters and chapters away. Okay. By the beginning of 74, Sertorius faced large-scale desertions, and his treatment of his men became severe and even cruel as his desperation and suspicions grew. Adding to Sertorius's problems, Pompey controlled and increasing much more of the Spanish province than he initially did with his victories, and was able to be easily supplied from Gaul by a loyal supporter. This would prove to be a chief talent of his. Yeah, I just touched on that. If Pompey can keep his men well fed, well watered, he's going to secure that ability before he engages an enemy. And it's amazing to me that he doesn't get the credit for this ability to organize and generalize, or as the word, he doesn't get the credit that he deserves for the ability to organize these armies and attack when he has an advantage. And that just blows my mind. If I'm not mistaken, the art of ancient warfare, if we're talking about the manipular legions, the hoplites, when men start fighting in formation to negate numeral superiority, it's always been the job of the general to place himself in a tactically advantageous position. And that's when the strike happens. That's when victories are won. You know, and we'll see armies maneuver, camp, draw up formation again and again. And when one general perceives that he's got his enemy at a tactical disadvantage, or that he himself is at a tremendous advantage tactically, that's the time to attack. So that is the art of war in the ancient world. So where were we? Okay, so Pompey's men, now that Pompey controlled more of the Spanish province, they could be easily supplied from Gaul by a local supporter and governor, M. Fonteius. So these new routes were thus not liable to being interrupted by pirates or Sertorius's new fleet, promised and delivered by King Mithridates. I love that guy. We'll see in Pompey's later career that he is going to always utilize his superiority at sea, and any advantage he has at sea, he's going to take. But here, he's clearly outgunned by the pirates, and of course, Sertorius's new fleet provided by King Mithridates, that he is not even going to attempt to bring in supplies by sea. That's not where he has an advantage. That's not where he has power. So he controls some good supply lines by land. A conspiracy of senior officers led by Perperna. I remember Perperna, the guy who escaped with Lepidus's army and became Sertorius's second in command. A conspiracy of senior officers led by Perperna resulted in the assassination of Sertorius in Osca. The date is a little muddy. Appian's narrative is unfortunately interrupted here. Great. Putting the assassination in 72 BC, if I remember. He does say in his Mithridatic War that, or rather, refers to Sertorius being dead by the winter of 73 and 72. It is thusly justifiable to date his death in 73. Sallust, who was a contemporary of Caesar who later wrote about the conspiracy of Catiline, mentions the tribune Licinius Macer making a speech anticipating Pompey's return that year. Also, two of Pompey's friends were successful that year in the consular elections, and Rome seems to be preparing for a triumphant return. So, all these things together, we are logically putting Sertorius' death in 73. The most important part of the war, and history fails to deliver. This isn't the most fastidiously documented time in ancient history, folks. But the important thing is, Sertorius was defeated. And the Spanish peninsula would soon be Pompey's. Pompey would not triumph, however, until 71, because Metellus, as rumor has it, retired to his own peaceful province, believing Pompey would soon mop up what resistance remained under Perperna. And supposedly, Metellus retired in complete decadence, extravagance, which has been increasing with his age. I'm not someone who likes to spread rumors, but, they're fun. So rumors had it that Metellus had gone soft as he got older and wanted to go relax and have lots of sex with the slaves and etc. Appian, who completely ignores the time gap we are talking of, if indeed there was one, claims that after Sertorius' death, Pompey and Perperna hurried to a decisive battle. Perperna apparently because he was rapidly losing support, which makes sense. The final battle paints Pompey as a much better commander than he was against Sertorius. And I know that Sertorius gave the inexperienced Pompey a good schooling, and rightfully so. I think it can be argued by a lot of historians. Hopefully some military historians out there could back me up. Sertorius was legit. I mean, he was one of the seriously one of the most badass commanders Rome has ever had. He did twice as well with half as much. It's unbelievable. The final battle paints Pompey as a much better commander than he was against Sertorius. Using Hannibalic tactics, he carefully led Perperna into an ambush. Pompey used 10 cohorts as a decoy, deploying them loosely and with much vulnerability. When Perperna's men attacks and pursues the fleeing cohorts, Pompey's hidden lines deployed, and the fleeing cohorts turned and faced Perperna in the front. He was surrounded on all three sides, and it was a decisive victory, aka massacre. Afterwards, news was brought that Perperna had been captured, and in exchange for his life, he offered Pompey letters as evidence that incriminated several consular senators in Rome, including some ex-consuls and ex-praetors. And it is to Pompey's eternal credit that without seeing Perperna, Pompey had him executed, and he burned the letters without even reading them. Thus, Pompey brought an end to the 16-year civil war, which had not benefited the Senate or the people. Now, a little bit more on Pompey and also his generalship. As much as his military achievements up into and including the Spanish War had distinguished Pompey, as much as his military achievements, it was Pompey's fair treatment of the enemy soldiers and the settlement of province that distinguished a sullen commander. Ha, that's funny. I don't mean sullen as in sad. I mean Sulla, big bag dictator. Cicero later recalls how Pompey guaranteed safety to many, many, many Sertorians and settled them peacefully in Sicily and Africa. Some were even allowed to return to public life in Rome. So that does kind of blow apart the propaganda of the boy butcher there. These men were dispersed to ensure continued peace inflicted on them by Pompey. And Pompey made it his way to reconcile Rome with her former enemies, and Pompey wanted to give them a fair chance. This is not the first time we'll see Pompey do this. And it says a lot about his magnanimous nature. And I'm sure if Luke was here on this episode, he would say, oh, it's not magnanimity at all. You know, it's a stratagem to be clement, to show clemency, you know, to treat your POWs, your defeated enemies, magnanimously, to treat them well, to settle them. Hey, here's a little money, here's a little farm. You know, don't fight me again. So I'm sure if Luke was here, he would argue that it's not a testament to Pompey's good nature as much as forward thinking into the future. Among other cities, Pompey founded, Jesus, I can't read the Latin word. Among other cities founded in Spain, Pompey founded Pompey's town. Today it's, Pamplona in the Vasconian territory. If I have any Spanish listeners, I'm sorry. I know almost nothing about modern geography. You know, I know like the ancient cities and their locations, but apparently Pompey city still exists today. It's Pamplona. And I'm not going to say that because I should have done a little more research on that. Anyway, you can look it up if you're interested. It's interesting, this continual imitation of Alexander the Great that we see in Pompey, namely in using his own name to rename new cities, which would serve as an everlasting reminder of his success. Alexandria is a good example of that. And throughout Pompey's career, he's got to name a few cities after himself. It's a little pompous, but it's awesome also. For some time, Pompey had been following a precedent set by Marius and Strabo of granting citizenship to certain Spaniards who had given loyal service to him and his party. Indeed, Pompey's personal clients were growing, and the consuls of 72, Aulgellius Poplicola and Cornelius Lentulus Claudianus, were Pompey's creatures as they passed a law that was ratified granting these Spanish people loyal to him citizenships. Gosh, I wish Luke was here. He'd go insane. Yeah, so Pompey's clientele is hugely growing and is becoming this gigantic force. We talked about his clients in Gaul, Picenum. You better believe there are some in Africa, Sicily now. He's also the most popular guy in Rome, so this guy is just swollen with well-wishers and supporters. And, I mean to interrupt the narrative again. We have talked about the client and patron relationship in Rome, and it is most basically sort of like you have a Roman who is in a wealthy position or a position of power, basically a position to grant favors and help out masses of people that are socially or financially inferior to him. And these clients would, you know, harangue their patron, normally at morning levies in some cases, would proceed with their patron to the forum so everyone could say, oh, look at Luke over there, look at all these, you know, people that think he's great. And this guy would be able to do things that he could, would be able to gain for his clients what he could with his power and influence or possibly his money. And in exchange, these people were expected to support his interest. If Luke was a politician, they would vote for him. If he was a general, they might conscript into his army. If, you know, the list is infinite. And there was the client and patron relationship on all levels. You know, you may have a patron and you also might have clients, and it breaks down. And this is a very, very immense, very, very important social institution in Rome. And I just want you folks to keep that in mind. So clearly at this point, Pompey's influence was already large. And as Pompey legally served the state, he also could grow supporters. And he really, really endeared some of these Spanish locals to him. And in fact, 20 years later, Caesar would be made aware of how strong Pompey's support still would be in the Spanish province. Well, there's two Spanish provinces, nearer Spain and further Spain. But Caesar would be made aware of how strong Pompey's support still was in Spain and how affectionate the people still were to Pompey. This is 20 years later. So there is absolutely something to be said about Pompey's ability to be generous and settle people in a way that's not going to lead them to hostility and fighting, especially to Rome. And if you think people hate government superpowers now, you should see what it was like 2,000 years ago. It is an unbelievable testament to Pompey's generosity and moderation that the providentials should remain so attached after 20 years to a general whose armies, you know, desolated their landscape. They foraged, they fought, they killed them, Pompey's armies devoured the Spanish countryside, and these people still had affection for him. So that is some pretty amazing leadership. But I should also note that even after Perperna's defeat, and we saw how the locals and the army were losing heart with Sertorius after he was murdered by his lieutenant Perperna, morality continued to fall naturally. And if you remember from the Lepidus affair, Perperna's men refused to fight with him when he landed in Spain unless he joined with Sertorius. And of course, Perperna would be an idiot not to join with him anyway, but you know, he didn't really inspire that much confidence to begin with. But even after Perperna's defeat, some cities in Spain still held out for a time. Yet even those towns weren't harshly treated by Pompey. Asca, Sertorius' old capital, retained its former status. Good job. Good job, Pompey, because right now we'd be reading this podcast and talking about what an ass you were if you would have burned that city to the ground. And, you know, Rome's had this old saying about, you know, the ram has touched a wall, and it's basically when a Roman army is invading an enemy camp, an enemy fortified city, they have every and all opportunities to surrender unconditionally, many times to the benefit of the inhabitants. But a lot of times once the siege engines start and the ram touches the wall and the siege begins, it's complete annihilation after that. And the Roman army has every right to complete conquest, every man, woman, child, dog, and chicken. And that happens quite a bit. But here we have Pompey again, magnanimously sparing Asca, the capital, and it even retained its status. So that was pretty awesome. According to John Leech, who is one of the few contemporary biographers of Pompey the Great, he says, and I quote, "Although most of the details of the settlement of Spain elude us, what a shame, it is clear that recrimination and punishment were kept to a minimum and peace and stability restored in an imaginative and far-sighted manner, such as the Spaniards had previously little cause to expect." With his love of efficiency and order and a soldier's respect for the qualities and rights of the provincials against whom and with whom he had been fighting, Pompey proved an ideal choice for the task of ending the civil war. And I also want to add that, you know, many times it is said that Pompey appears ill at ease around his fellow nobles and at public occasion. He's also described later as a man with great charm and approachability, who had a knack of bestowing favors without arrogance or offense. Some sources make him appear outright aloof and incompetent. Despite Plutarch's more romantic idea of his character, he constantly wasn't the politician Cicero or Caesar was. And, you know, and take that with a grain of salt because, you know, Caesar was a very serious criminal, as we'll find out later. And as far as Cicero is concerned, you know, we do have a lot of these, you know, we do have a lot of these very lovely, very romantic praises that Cicero says of Pompey. And no doubt he was that way to his person. And they did enjoy a lifetime friendship. Cicero leaves for us about 1,000 letters. And I've probably read most of them, at least most of the letters to Atticus. And having the unique chance to be able to dive into an ancient's personal correspondence with his best friend and basically like a brother, it's helped us invariably piecing together historical facts. But, you know, he does have a lot of negative things to say about Pompey's political ability, and we'll explore that more. So, you know, you do have some praise and you do have some criticism coming from Cicero. But the point I'm trying to make is we have a lot of this personification of Pompey as being an aloof and clumsy politician, where there's also a lot of hard evidence that he did a lot of very cunning and very well organized settling and administering. And I think in Pompey's case, it is mainly his dealings with the provincials, his subordinates, his social inferiors, that his unusual qualities of generosity can be seen. And I personally feel that it's a sign of a good man, that is a man who treats his inferiors with dignity and esteem. You know, the old saying, or maybe it's just me who says it, you know, I can't stand when men are only good to their superiors or their associates, and they treat people lower than them like dirt. And, you know, it's the old saying, go, that you can really, it's really a testament to a man's character how he treats his inferiors. You know, most men with half a brain have every incentive to treat their betters with esteem. And I plan to challenge head on some of these popular notions regarding Pompey's political life and some of these other ideas about his character, not least of all his military accomplishments. It is unanimous among Pompey's contemporaries and modern historians, however, that Pompey inspired love and loyalty to the people he was close to. He fell in love with his wives and was a devoted husband. That's nice. Anyway, by the end of 72 BC, while Spain was being reestablished, Pompey received word that a slave rebellion of 100,000 men had defeated two consular armies in Picenum. The leader of the slave revolt was a man named Spartacus. After repeated failures of lesser generals, the command against Spartacus now fell into the hands of a certain Marcus Licinius Crassus, who was now, by all accounts, the richest man in Rome. And you all probably remember Crassus from the civil wars when he fought on the Sullan side. And he was the one who succeeded at the Battle of the Colline Gate and kind of saved Sulla's ass, quite frankly, who by now had become immensely rich, as I said. And he allegedly made a lot of his fortune off of, by buying up the houses of some of the proscribed men during Sulla's proscription at knockdown prices. You hear all sorts of shrewd, kind of crooked stories of him, which I take with a grain of salt. I mean, one popular tale about Crassus I want to tell you real quick that I really like is he had a fire brigade. Of course, there was no police force or fire force in ancient Rome. Like, we all know that, right? We covered that in the Republic. But he had a fire brigade made out of trained slaves that he furnished out of his own pocket, naturally. And when a building would catch on fire, which happened a lot in Rome, he would rush to the scene with his fire brigade and ask the traumatized owner who might own the adjacent buildings or the entire block if he could purchase them on the spot at knockdown fraction of the cost prices. If they said no, then he just said, all right, back to bed, and he'd let the buildings burn down. If they say yes, he would quickly put out the fire with his trained slaves and resell the area at a profit. Either he could he might be able to demolish the buildings next to the burning one and the fire there, and then he owns the rest of the block unharmed, or maybe he can save the structure itself, and this would be a huge profit to him. I mean, imagine your house burning and someone saying, hey, I'll give you $10,000 for that house that's on fire. And you're just like, oh gosh, I can't believe my luck. That was Crassus, allegedly, and more on Crassus later. What is important, now is that I make the listeners familiar with this man, for his fate in life will play a large role in the life of Pompey Magnus. His destiny and Pompey's and Julius Caesar's and Cicero's and the Republic's are going to be so interwoven, it's unbelievable. So you'll hear a lot more. So where was I? The slave revolt of Spartacus. Okay, so Pompey saw and perhaps hoped that he would be able to again come to the state's aid. He left Spain in the late autumn of 72 and wintered in Gaul. He intended to cross the Alps in Italy with his first opportunity in the spring. I don't know if you folks have ever seen the Alps, but you can't cross them in the wintertime. Not with an army, at any rate. His departure from Spain was marked with the erection of a triumphal monument at the summit of the pass over the Pyrenees. The monument recorded that he, Pompey the Great, had brought 876 towns under Roman sway from the Alps to further Spain. Although the monument emphasized the great man's conquest, it would not be the victorious battles that would lead to his unprecedented success. It would be the control over hundreds of communities of Gaul and Spain. Laborious planning, brilliant organization, and the ability to learn from his opponents and colleagues. I know, too bad Luke's not here. He would get a kick out of that. The monument Pompey left in Spain bore not a mention of Metellus. Thank you for listening.